From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Free trade is getting a thumping on the campaign trail. Sunday in Flint, Michigan, Hillary and Bernie Sanders took off the gloves and went at each other on international trade agreements. Clinton said she would go after companies that aim to push jobs overseas. Sanders accused her of finding religion on this issue a little bit too late, he said. On the Republican side, Donald Trump says the U.S. is losing its shirt with its trade deals, threatening huge tariffs. This hour on Point, free trade takes a beating on the 2016 campaign trail. You can join us on air or online with this conversation is always on. Should, could the U.S. walk away, renegotiate its international trade agreements? Is that dreaming? Is that necessary? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We pay attention to everything coming in there. Later in this hour, we will look at stagnant wages for millennials. But first, free trade under fierce fire. Let's listen to a little bit of Bernie Sanders responding to a question from a Detroiter who was in the audience there in Michigan, who wanted to know what the candidates would do to keep jobs in the United States.
Permanent normal trade relations with China cost us millions of jobs. Look, I was on a picket line in the early 1990s against NAFTA because you didn't need a PhD in economics to understand that American workers should not be forced to compete against people in Mexico making 25 cents an hour.
Hillary Clinton kind of uncomfortably going foot to foot there. Bill Clinton pushed a lot of free trade. NAFTA was there. President Barack Obama, of course, has pushed hard for TPP, and she wants it as well. But it's not just Democrats talking about this. Fox debate last week, Donald Trump was asked to respond to former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney's comments about how Trump's foreign policy would make America less safe.
If you look at China, and if you look at Japan, and if you look at Mexico, both at the border, by the way, where they're killing us, both at the border and with trade, and every other country we do business with, we are getting absolutely crushed on trade.
Trump, trade, it's killing us. We're getting crushed on trade. Joining me first from Washington is Neil King, Global Economics Editor for The Wall Street Journal. Neil, great to have you back with us. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
So, free trade, liberalized trade has been such a deep orthodoxy in this country. I mean, resisted and lots of complaints and lots of pain for a long time, but it has absolutely ruled the roost. Is that coming undone in this campaign season, Neil?
You know, I think it's been coming undone for a long time. And you go back, and I'm sure you remember the 1999 Seattle protests, which was extremely violent, pushback against the big World Trade Organization talks at that time. There's been this deep kind of anti-globalization sentiment. But what we're seeing now is this whole skepticism towards the very concept of free trade, liberalized trade as an intrinsic good that's really seeped across the political establishment in Washington. Trump is definitely embodying it, but you know, we witnessed the extreme difficulty that Obama saw this year just getting fast track authority, which is basic procedural vote in the House or in both sides of Congress, to move forward on this Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. That was extremely hard, with a lot of opposition also on the Republican side and very, very little support on the Democratic side. And it, I guess, as much as anything, it just points to the fact that there's a weariness overall, a kind of economic sense of embattlement within the United States across large portions of the country that have seen a hollowing out of the manufacturing sector, have seen the sort of stagnant wages that you mentioned you'll be doing a program on later. And I think there's just a diminished faith in the model. It also, I just think there's, which is one thing we've seen a lot of in this election, just a diminished faith, sharply diminished faith in trusting leaders that things will turn out the way they say they will. And that's one thing that Bernie Sanders has hit on a lot, going after Hillary Clinton when it comes to NAFTA and other things that either she or her husband was in support of. Look how it turned out. I mean, we can debate and discuss, did it really turn out as badly as Bernie Sanders says it did, or for that matter, were some of these forces inevitable, whether there was a NAFTA or not? And clearly a lot of them were. But all the same, it's very much felt across the country that these deals, the you know, most the normalized trade agreements that we had 15 years ago or so with China, and bringing China on the world scene has dramatically changed the environmental, the economic picture in the United States. And that's the sentiment that Bernie Sanders is hitting on, and of course, very strongly also Donald Trump.
Is anybody on these stages, still standing on these stages, Neil, resisting this? I mean, you can go back. I mean, never mind Ronald Reagan and the Bushes 1 and 2. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, very strong for these liberalized free trade policies. Is anybody still holding that flag in these debates to your ear?
You know, the only one that's really anything close to the old orthodoxy on the Republican side would be John Kasich. And even though he's also expressed some skepticism about some things coming from pretty strong manufacturing state of Ohio, he's still out there and will say on a debate stage, I am a free trader. Marco Rubio says similar things, and in a funny way, you've seen a real metamorphosis just this year or over the last year with Ted Cruz, where he actually even authored an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal along with Paul Ryan in support of the same Fast Track Authority and also basically in support of the Pacific Trade Agreement. Yeah. But he's since also backed off, which is partly a sort of Senate, more Congress-oriented jockeying with the president. But still, there's a lot of wobbliness among basically everybody. And it's also, of course, very sharply on Hillary Clinton's side, too, where she's also undergone her own change since she was Secretary of State.
TPP looked good to her once, doesn't look good to her now. It's hard to rewrite the 90s when NAFTA came in. And then there's Donald Trump on the other side. Here he was yesterday at a rally in North Carolina.
All this free trade. You know what? It's free trade for them, not free trade for us. We're losing our shirts. And I think free trade's fine. But the leaders of these other countries, whether it's China, $500 billion a year trade deficit with China. What the hell good is that for us? Where does it help us?
Neil, let me ask you, what's real here and what's campaign talk? Can these deals be remade? I mean, these are agreements. TPP's not done yet, but all the others, CAFTA, NAFTA, and you name it, there's a lot of talk about just, you know, tearing them up or walking away. I mean, what's really possible?
I can't see under what circumstances or even how one would go about remaking or unmaking agreements like NAFTA or stepping out of the World Trade Organization or trying to go in reverse when it comes to our relations with China. They're built into the fabric now. That's not to say that they were perfect or great, but it's, you know, you look, even today, the numbers came out of China that China's own exports in January were down almost 25%.
Yeah.
So you see in China undergoing a big change of its own, moving more into being a kind of consumer-based society, somewhat more like ours, its own export-based economy under some question, under some pressure. And, you know, it just goes to show that the threat that we saw, and it's a continued one for that matter from China, is also a changing picture. Needless to say, Donald Trump overstates things, and he acts as if a trade deficit is automatically a negative thing when that's not necessarily the case. It's also the case that a lot of the things that China exports, you just look at something like the iPhone, many of which are made there.
Yep.
I mean, in that deal, we actually, you know, the people that work in the various Apple stores or the ones who are designing the software and marketing it, et cetera, get in many ways the better end of that deal as opposed to the people who are in a factory actually making the phone.
But you've got people, I mean, I think I heard Sanders say, let's bring that iPhone in particular, let's bring it home. I mean, everything seems to be nothing sacred in terms of the old orthodoxy, everything at least rhetorically on the table. Neil, stand by there in Washington. Joanne's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Joanne, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello, and thank you for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to share with people, well, I have two comments, one about immigration and that was supposed to be curbed by NAFTA, and I worked as an immigration attorney in California, and I did not see people stop coming here.
What about trade, Joanne? What about trade?
Well, trade, I actually traveled to Mexico on a congressional delegation in 1993 with as a staff person. It was a government operations committee, went there. Bernie Sanders, as a representative, was on the trip. We visited. It was either a general, I remember being General Motors Delphi plant, but it could have changed hands.
Okay.
Mr. Sanders discussed
what about
Delco. Well, it was an electronics plant They hired a lot of young women from the interior of the country. And as we walked out, we were supposed to then go visit a nursery for the workers of the children. And at that point, Bernie stopped and he said, I want to go see how the people really live. And he went off script and he started walking into the neighborhood. The councilor officers kind of flipped out.
Yeah.
Like, oh, but Mr. Sanders, right. Oh, look it over here. And he stopped. He said, who do you work for, you know, the United States government or General Motors? He said, these people are not going to be able to buy a car. And so it seemed pretty obvious to me back then. And here I am. I've returned to Detroit after being a while back. It is just horrifying to see people losing their houses, the empty houses, because the offspring of people who had the parents and grandparents had auto-related jobs, they don't have those jobs.
But, Joanne, can we turn back the hands of time? I mean, so much water is under the bridge here in the years since then.
Well, I think that's why people are supporting Bernie Sanders and on the other side Donald Trump, because they'd like to see something change. And I think Bernie cared about the people being exploited in Mexico and people, you know, losing their livelihoods over here. And, I don't know the magic answer to it, but we definitely need to take a look at it all.
Pretty crazy. I mean, because, of course, you've also seen the numbers. I mean, we have that. This trade has brought up standards of living in many countries. I mean, look at China. In 1993, China was still poor. Now China is far from poor, and a lot of people have benefited from that. When you want to go after poverty abroad, trade is up. But here at home, people up in arms, Donald Trump speaking to that, Bernie Sanders speaking to that, Hillary Clinton with the Clinton's legacy around NAFTA, kind of uncomfortable, but diving in there as well. When we come back, we'll talk with Robert Kuttner from the American Prospect, Jeffrey Schott from the Peterson Institute, Neil King with the Wall Street Journal. It's so good to have you here. Please stand by right there in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about trade on the campaign trail, for years we have been told free trade was necessary medicine, told by Republican presidents, Democratic presidents. Now, from Sanders to Trump, candidates are beating up on free trade. And we're asking, is the pro-free trade orthodoxy breaking in this country? You can join us. Do you think these other countries will really let us out of these agreements we've signed? Is this trade backlash smart? Is it necessary? Is it populist crazy talk? Is it just happening? Time to adjust. Time to change. Neil King is with us, global economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. Here's just three in a row here. Clinton, Sanders, Trump on trade. First, Hillary, a little uncomfortable there in Flint as Bernie just bashed deals, including those that the Clintons helped push through in the 90s.
When it comes to trade deals, here's my standard. I won't support any agreement unless it helps create good jobs and higher wages for American workers and protects our national security. I need to be able to look into the eyes of any hardworking American anywhere in our country and say this deal will help raise your income.
Okay, but does that make the pot boil? Not clear. Bernie Sanders, ready to call all this, using a Trump word, stupid, in the Flint debates.
Those trade policies, as much as any other set of policies, has resulted in the shrinking of the American middle class. And I'll tell you what else it did. It's not only job loss by the millions, it is the race to the bottom, so that new jobs in manufacturing, in some cases today, pay 50% less than they did 20 years ago. How stupid is that trade policy?
Sounds like Trump there with his language. Trump says free trade, great, but he says he wants to redo our trade. Listen here, redo them 100%. Last week in Michigan.
I say free trade, great, but not when they're beating us so badly. With China, we're going to lose $505 billion in terms of trades. You just can't do it. Mexico, $58 billion. Japan, probably about, they don't know it yet, but about $109 billion. Every country we lose money with. As far as I'm concerned, we have to redo our trade deals 100%.
This should be interesting. Neil King is Global Economics Editor at the Wall Street Journal. Please stand by. Neil, Robert Kuttner is with me in the studio, co-founder, co-editor of The American Prospect. He's professor in social policy at the Heller School at Brandeis University. Bob Kuttner, welcome. Great to have you here.
Nice to be here.
What is going on? Are we going to undo all this orthodoxy, turn American minds around, turn American policy around, or is this just flamboyant talk on the campaign trail?
I think there has been a bottled-up backlash against the orthodoxy because the orthodoxy doesn't serve the interests of most people. And I think it took a year like this to have this become flagrant and be actively debated. When Dick Gephardt ran for president in 88 mm-hmm. as a critic of free trade, when he ran for the Democratic nomination, he just got crucified by editorial opinion
yeah.
as a kind of a flat earth type. And you can see what's happened to the economy since
88. If you weren't for it, you were an idiot. You
yeah,
didn't
right.
get it.
Here's the story, it seems to me. There is a simple-minded raw meat critique of liberal trade a la Trump where – the problem is them. It's China. It's Japan. It's Mexico.
Is Bernie Sanders that different?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I think there's a more complicated critique that mm-hmm. I associate okay. myself with, mm-hmm. which has to do with who's the them and who's the us. I think in the more complicated critique, the them is a bipartisan elite, a corporate elite that uses trade to undermine economic and social regulation so that if you're a corporation, if you're a bank – you can outrun labor regulations. You can outrun enviro regulations. You can certainly outrun financial regulations by moving off.
You can outrun union wages as well.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. by moving offshore. And since the WTO was the World Trade Organization mm-hmm. was created in 95, they have changed the rules of trade so that if somebody is regulating your business, you can define that, you as a business leader, you can define that as an infringement on your property rights. That's something new. That's not like cutting tariffs. That's not like getting rid of quotas. And I have a second point to make if you have time.
Yes, I do.
The other point is that Japan and China and Korea and other Asian countries use economic nationalism. They use partnerships between government and industry. They're yeah. very protectionist. They're very mercantilist. And the United States of America, in its trade deals with these countries, tolerates that because it helps some American businesses. Mm-hmm. So if Intel wants to cut a deal with China where China gives them $1 billion in subsidies and the deal is Intel has to share its technology mm-hmm. with China mm-hmm. and in exchange it gets all these subsidized factories, it gets cheap labor. The administration, and that's true whether it's one of the Bushes or Clinton or Obama, says, that's great. That's great for Intel, so it must be great for America. But in the meantime, a lot of tech jobs that might have been created here get created there. And a coercive mercantilist policy mm-hmm. on the part of the Chinese gets not only tolerated but enabled by the United States. Now, that's a more complicated critique. You're not going to hear that from Donald Trump. Donald Trump's critique is China bad, U.S. good. I think Sanders is a little closer to the more complicated and, in my view, accurate critique of these trade deals.
Neil King, but is there room in this picture for the U.S. to suddenly get more mercantilist? I mean, for a long time, as I understood the orthodoxy, it was free trade is great, and so the United States will be the champion of free trade. Even if it costs us a little something net-net, it's going to be in our benefit. If the U.S. now tries to get mercantilists like Japan or China, who's going to, is the organic world as it's grown up really going to tolerate that, going to make way for that?
I'm not sure whether we're necessarily going to tilt towards mercantilism. I do think that, you can even look at some of the pressures now. There is a steep rise in the number of anti-dumping cases that are being filed and actually mm-hmm. approved at Commerce, most of it oriented towards China. There are various mechanisms in place, and there's a lot of talk, not very fully fleshed out on the campaign trail, of trying to police things better. I don't really see that there's going to necessarily be some sharp turn that would put the U.S. in some starkly different position that it's in. But on the other hand, it's pretty clear that the sort of momentum that was there coming out of the Second World War and with the creation of the precursor to the WTO and then after the WTO's creation, that momentum is really waning sharply. And it may be, if we get the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal through, that it may be the last big multilateral deal like that of its kind. And even its fate – is somewhat unclear. And part of the reason that Robert pointed to is that what we normally think about in trade deals is lowering tariffs and decreasing barriers to entry for goods, you know, coming into ports is increasingly not what it's really about. It's about all kinds of difficult, sometimes arcane, environmental rules, regulatory matters, IP protections for drug patents and things like that.
Intellectual property,
Yeah, exactly, which are arcane, difficult to understand, hard to talk about on the campaign trail, but also very important for, you know, people's daily lives in ways that are also hard to show what the upside is. It is interesting, I'll just note quickly, I mean, Donald Trump in that fragment you had said that trade with Mexico cost us $58 billion. What he's talking about, that's the difference in how much we sent them versus how much we brought in from Mexico. But it's amazing, if you go back, the amount of trade between the U.S. and Mexico before NAFTA was actually surprisingly small compared to now, and our exports to Mexico have grown just exponentially during that time. And the actual gap, the $58 billion in terms of the proportion of trade, is not actually all that much different from what it was when NAFTA came in. And both countries have grown immensely in terms of the amount of trade they've done between each other. And Mexico itself, because of its economy, has gotten to be a lot stronger and is, for all that Donald Trump says, actually sending way fewer workers our way than it did in the times when its economy was much weaker. Yeah. So there's an upside to that. The fact that Mexico has improved economically, there's an upside to the U.S.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to know where Trump would come down in an actual Trump administration. Back in November, there was a business debate, Fox-sponsored, and the businessman Donald Trump, you could hear his wheels turning, saying, look, we can't have wages too high in this country or we won't be able to compete, sort of acknowledging that global economy. Here's Trump then.
Taxes too high, wages too high. We're not going to be able to compete against the world. I hate to say it, but we have to leave it the way it is. People have to go out, they have to work really hard, and they have to get into that upper stratum. But we cannot do this if we are going to compete with the rest of the world. We just can't do it.
Not sure where Donald Trump actually comes down. A call, and then to Jeffrey Schutt. Kevin in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I come from what was a textile and furniture powerhouse in Southside Virginia, Martinsville and Henry County.
Yeah.
We had the world's largest nylon plant, the world's largest furniture plant. We were the sweatshirt capital of the world. It's all gone now. And not only are the factory workers gone, but the middle class in Martinsville and Henry County is gone. And I think nice white people out there need to understand that free trade affects them in the long run, too. Martinsville and Henry County was an amazingly vibrant and wonderful place to grow up, and it is a ghost town now.
Kevin, I really appreciate your call. Jeffrey Schutt is with us from Palm Coast, Florida. He's senior fellow in international trade policy at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Jeffrey Schutt, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Now, I know you and many others, of course, are strong supporters of free trade, liberalized trade. You hear the thumping it's taking on the trail. You hear how that resonates with callers like Kevin, who's looking at his home turf there in Southern Virginia and saying the middle class just got wiped out. That sounds like what we're hearing from Bernie Sanders is our long championing of free trade over in this country, Jeffrey.
Well, it's become much more nuanced, as Neil and Bob have mentioned.
Is it really nuanced when you listen to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump? It doesn't sound nuanced to me, sir.
Yeah, but this is campaign fluffery. It really nothing what they that they're talking about is doable if you're actually governing. As Neil said, the cost of ripping up trade agreements would be extraordinary in terms of lost jobs in the United States, and lost incomes in the United States.
How would those job losses occur? Just paint the picture for us, Jeffrey. Donald Trump says he's going to come in and put, I think he said 45% tariffs on Chinese goods, or if we rip up deals or try to, what's the scenario you picture?
You have an implosion of trade, and our exports suffer. And those are our most competitive, our strongest firms will take the biggest hits. The firms that are growing our employment will take the biggest hits. But this is all missing the point.
Okay.
Trade agreements are just a very small part of the story of how America competes in the global economy. The global economy has changed, and we are not changing enough to keep up with it in terms of improving our own competitiveness. We're not doing our own homework. We're not investing in our infrastructure. And as a result, the cost of transportation, the cost of educating our children is creating big taxes on U.S. companies that are trying to compete in the world economy.
Yeah, but we're not supposed to educate our own children? How do we compete without doing that?
We're not doing enough. We're not investing enough in America.
But you hear all the candidates saying, make these companies, you know, bring those jobs here and that money here, and we'll use that money to fix America.
Right. But what is, and they're going to tell an American company to invest here or somewhere else? You have to create incentives through tax policy, through expenditure policy, to make America an attractive place to invest. And a lot of investment is coming to the United States, is being done by American firms, is being done by foreign firms.
Boy, on the campaign trail, you would think that nobody does it. It's all going abroad, and some kind of big axe is going to come down and stop all that. Bob Cutner.
Well, my friend Jeff Schott says none of this is doable. Let me give you an example.
If you're really in office, if you win.
Yes. Let me give you an example of a few things that are, in fact, doable and should have been done and could be done.
Okay.
You could say to the Chinese state, which, after all, is a communist one-party government, hey, we would love to trade with you guys.
Okay.
But if you want to have relatively liberal trade with us, you may not say to Intel, if you want to come sell products in China – you got to share with us your technology. You may not say to Boeing, if you want to sell aircraft in China, you have to build them in China or you can't sell them here.
Can we really say that? Then they say, okay, don't make your stuff. Yeah, but then they say, don't make your stuff here in China. They've got the factories now. Will Intel be competitive globally if it can't have access to its Chinese factories?
Well, of course it will. The problem is we are being hollowed out because of these deals. Because we compete with one hand tied behind our back, we can say to China, sorry, if you want to be defined as a good free trader, you cannot give your companies capital at below zero interest
rates. You sound sort of like Donald Trump saying these were stupid deals. We can make better deals.
I would not use Donald Trump's rhetoric, but I think American trade policy, and this is the one-liner.
Yep.
American trade policy has been very good for Goldman. It's been very good for Citi. It's been very good for some international corporations. It's been terrible for everybody else. And it's no accident that the Obama administration, the Clinton administration, both Bush administrations are in bed with these same corporate elites because that's why they make these deals.
Jeffrey Schott, have we been dopes all these years and all these long, long, long trade negotiations? Suckers.
No, we've been trying to take the world as it is and improve it through these trade agreements. And there have been substantial improvements. China signed on to a tremendous number of new obligations which are enforceable and which are being the subject of numerous dozens of complaints that the United States has brought against China in the WTO, in the World Trade Organization. And we've won almost all of them.
Except China's policy on the ground doesn't change.
No, when they lose a case, they comply.
Yeah, but their whole system of state-led quasi-socialism, quasi-capitalism is still completely intact.
You think that's going to be changed from Washington, Bob Cutner? You think they're really going to like have
we have the world's biggest market. We can condition access to that market on something approaching a level playing field. Elites in both parties have not done that.
Neil King, what's possible here, Neil? What can Americans actually believe in when they hear this very hot rhetoric on trade as possible actual changes?
I'm going to answer all the questions of what's possible.
Sure.
I mean, I do think there's a happy middle ground in some of this. I mean, I do agree with what Jeff said, that it is the effort to improve the world as it is. I mean, what is overstated in the trade agreement discussion is that it points to all changes going on in the world economy as though they're the result of trade agreements. And overlooking automation and a whole variety of other forces, just the ability of the world to have globalized in the way that it did, that happens to have overlapped with the time. basically since NAFTA in the early 90s when the whole world changed in just profound ways. Also, though, we are dealing with this huge force called China that is, as Bob is pointing out, lives by very different rules. Is this, you know, heavily capitalistic society that is all the same, a one-state dominated society that gives a lot of perks to a lot of creaky industries in ways that are felt all over the world and not beneficial ways often. So,
Neil King, we're up against it right there. We're so grateful to you for being with us today. Global economics editor at the Wall Street Journal, Robert Kuttner with the American Prospect, Jeffrey Schott with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. When we come back, millennial wages, they're stuck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are going to take a look at millennial wages. Last year, millennials overtook baby boomers as the largest age cohort in the United States and the largest share of the voting age population. But a new report says despite their numbers, despite being highly educated, despite increased productivity, millennial 30-year-olds are making no more than 30-year-olds of the 1980s. That's a long time ago. That hurts. And a lot of millennials feel the pain, maybe you. You can join us. Millennials, do you feel stuck, underpaid, screwed? With me now from Washington is Brendan Duke, Associate Director of Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. His new report is, When I Was Your Age, Millennials and the Generational Wage Gap. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Brendan Duke, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What did you find?
So basically what I looked at is I looked at how much a 30-year-old makes today versus 10 years ago and 30 years ago. And I found that, you know, despite an increase in education of 30-year-olds, despite the economy growing, becoming more productive, 30-year-olds don't make any more than they did 30 years ago, which I found personally a discouraging result as a 30-year-old.
Well, as a 30-year-old, well, what's the big surprise in that? Nobody's making more, we're told again and again, that wages have stagnated right across the board. Is this just, you only care about your own age cohort? Or, you know, what's how shocking can this be?
Well, it is shocking. You know, I study the income distribution for a living. And, you know, over 30 years, you know, incomes and wages, they've stagnated, which means they've been growing slowly. So, you know, after inflation, less than 1% a year. That's not very fast, especially when we have an economy that's grown a ton over the past 30 years. So, you know, when I did the calculations, what I was expecting is what you see with the income distribution, what you see with the overall wage distribution, where median incomes and median wages overall have gone up, but too slowly. But it was shocking to me to find that wages and compensation for 30-year-olds hasn't gone up a bit over the past 30 years.
Have they gone up more slowly than their parents, than middle-aged Americans?
So 30-year-olds, their wages have gone up more slowly than 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds, yes. And and the overall wage.
Define millennials for us. Born when to when? How old are they now?
According to Pew, it's folks born between 1981 and 1997. And, you know, I think one of the kind of scary things in the report is that the last year I observe is folks who were 30 in 2014, which, you know, translates roughly to the class of 2006.
Okay.
So these are folks who graduated before the beginning of the Great Recession. So, you know, over the next few years, I'm going to expect that it's going to get worse as, you know, we see the folks who graduated into the worst job market that we've had since the Great Depression.
And are you making a political judgment out of this? Are you tying this to the famous support for Bernie Sanders that we're seeing rather widely among many young voters?
Well, I think it explains a great deal of that, folks, you know, they did what they were told. You know, they've been going to college. They've been doing these unpaid internships. They've been trying really, really hard to, you know, get a good foothold in the labor market, And, you know, they're not seeing their wages really grow, and they're not seeing, you know, the pie has grown a ton, but for, you know, most 30-year-olds, their share of the pie, you know, has shrunk, you know, by that measure. So I do think that there is, you know, there are political ramifications to this.
Brendan Duke the Center for American Progress, kind of a liberal think tank there in Washington, 30 years old, crunching the numbers and saying, what's up? The pie's grown, but 30-year-old millennials are doing no better than millennials or 30-year-olds in the 1980s. Brendan, stand by there in Washington. With me in the studio right now is Alicia Sasser-Modestino, professor of economics and public policy at Northeastern University. Alicia, welcome back to On Point. Great to see you.
Good to be here.
So what do you make of this? Brendan dives in, crunches the numbers, and says, what's going on? Millennials are getting the short end of the stick. How do you see what's happening?
I actually see what's happening to millennials is not all that different from what's happening to other workers. And in fact, I would say there's kind of two stories going on with millennials, and it depends very much on whether you went to college or not. So if you separate out college-educated millennials from those who did not go to college, research from the Pew Research Center shows that college-educated millennials saw their annual incomes grow by about 4% relative to Gen Xers. So that would be about compared to those who graduated in 1995. Mm-hmm. In comparison, if you're just a high school graduate as a millennial, your wages actually did not go up. And because of that, we've seen a greater disparity between college and non-college educated millennials, which has been reflected more largely across the economic spectrum.
But is there still something that Brendan's got the pulse of here? I mean, I'm looking at a piece here, a study out of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, said the rising cost of school, this is a piece about it, of school has combined with the chilly labor market to create a perfect storm, low youth wages that make it hard to pay off record high student debt. And this San Francisco Federal Reserve found that since 2009, wages for recent college grads have grown 60%, recent college grads, 60% more slowly than those of the general population. That sounds like a ding on millennials themselves.
Absolutely. So I
including think college educated.
Right. And so I think what's going on here is not necessarily that if you look at the pay stubs of millennials that they're earning less than previous generations at those same ages, but that they came to the labor market at a time when we're facing an enormous crisis. And so they've had a harder start to their careers. And at the same time, you're very right. They have taken on enormous debt from their college education. So their paychecks have to go even further than those of previous generations. So they're in a bigger hole in terms of debt. They've started off their careers during a particularly bad time of the labor market. And that's continued over time. So the Council of Economic Advisors showed that the typical employed college graduate who entered the market in the mid to late 1990s saw their wages increase by around 50% between the ages of 23 and 28. In comparison, the millennials have only seen their wages increase by about 25% between the ages of 23 and 28. So certainly their wages are growing more slowly. They've taken on more debt and they're having a harder time in the labor market.
And for most people, when you're young is when you expect wages to accelerate rapidly. That's when you get your big growth. Once you hit some sort of higher career place, for most people, they don't grow that fast.
Absolutely. There's a recent study by some researchers at the New York Federal Reserve Bank that showed younger workers who enter the workforce in lower wage jobs will have a hard time catching up later in their careers. And part of that is because, as you said, most of your wage increases are early on in your career. These folks are also less likely to find another job that pays substantially more as they get older, mm-hmm. and you often stick to with the job that you have, and so you're kind of on this lower wage trajectory for your career lifetime.
Brendan, is this just about the Great Recession? It threw a monkey wrench into everything. Once we work our way past that, millennials be A-okay?
So the Great Recession represents a huge challenge, and you know a key thing that you know we forget is you know it started in December 2007. You know. For me, that was when I was a senior in college. I'm 30 years old now. Mm-hmm. You know, my friends are, you know, starting families, trying to buy houses. So this has been going on for a while. And, you know, it really represents a lost decade for a lot of folks. So I do think that's a big part of it. One of the surprising things I did find in my data, though, was that, you know, you saw a sharp spike in wages for 30-year-olds between 1996 and 2002. But then it leveled off after that point. So that does say that, you know, there all was not going fine for 30-year-olds before the Great Recession. But I do think the slack in the labor market has had a really strong downward pressure on wages for 30-year-olds.
And it can really drive people nuts. I mean, we heard this interview last week on NPR's Morning Edition with Yuki Noguchi talking with a Cornell University grad, Samuel Smith, asked about the psychological burden of his enormous student loan debt, even though he's fully employed.
The best way I can handle it is to try to not think about it, because when I do start thinking about it, I have some serious panic attacks. For the past couple of days, I have been in panic attacks.
$190,000 in student debt. No wonder he's having panic attacks, but he's not alone. That's big. But Victor in Buffalo, New York is calling. Victor, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Good to be on the show, Tom. I just wanted to say I actually jumped into labor market pre-college. Got into the housing trade in 2005. I'm 32 now.
Okay.
And it was a brutal time, as you can imagine, dealing with property management work. And really, it flatlined my salary in the upper 20,000s for better than 6 years.
Wow.
Only in the last 3 years have I actually worked up to making $40,000 a year. And based on the call and the direction of the conversation, the only positive I can say, I'm married, I'm a father of three, I rent, and I am not in debt. I owe no one anything right now, and that's the best I can make of it.
Well, I mean, those are all great things, and lucky to be in that situation. But let me just take those numbers to Alicia here. I mean, 32 years old, got a family. He doesn't have the debt, but, you know, it 6 years in the 20,000s, you know, working hard, and only now at 32 getting to $40,000. Now, there's lots of variables here, but that hardly sounds like, you know, an easy street launch pad for Victor in Buffalo.
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, unfortunately, we still have a lot of slack in the labor market. There was a recent report that came out by Brookings that showed that right now we're only back to about 60% of the labor market's capacity in terms of the employment to population ratio.
But the unemployment rate was 4.9% last week. That sounds healthy, but you're saying still a lot on the sidelines who can come in and flood the market or creep back in and keep the slack there.
Absolutely. And we have seen people starting to come back in. So the labor force participation rate in the last jobs report did tick up a little bit. We're seeing more people come in off the sidelines. And I think, unfortunately, for millennials, we've seen that because of this labor market slack, they are underemployed, even if they are employed, such as this gentleman. And they've seen slow to no wage growth because they're taking jobs that perhaps don't even require the skills that they have right now.
Sarah in Boston, you're on the air, Sarah.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What's your situation?
I'm just calling as an example. I'm 29, graduated in December of 2009 from undergrad, took a few years to do AmeriCorps, worked here and there, and then went to school at BU for grad school, and now have, you know, $60,000 in debt, and from last year to this year, moved from a $40,000 salary to $43,000.
Okay.
And expectation of growing a career to up to $90,000, you know, you'd hope that with inflation, the growth of the salary would be more than that. But
you mean $90,000 by when? By what age do you anticipate you'll hit 90?
By the end of my career. By the end of, I work in nonprofit work.
So you're thinking like when you're ready to retire, you might be at 90.
Yeah.
Though what that means in terms of inflation, who knows? Years. Who knows? So how do you feel about that whole picture? $60,000 in debt, $43,000 in income?
I felt very much a resonance with the gentleman who was saying the best I can do is not to think about it, sort of. You know, you try to be proactive and plan if you want to have a family, but it's hard to, in a way, you have to just come to terms with it and take it for what it is, you know, do your best.
Sarah, I appreciate your call a lot. You and Victor as well. I mean, Brendan, the answer is like, don't think about it? Resignation? Like, this is a discouraging sort of framework for living and looking forward.
Well, you know, I work in Washington, D.C., so we think about policy here, and I think that policy is where we can begin to develop some hope so that we can, you know, begin to fix the labor market and wages for young adults, especially those young adults who are going from young adult to just straight adult. And, you know, there's a few things here. First is that, you know, the Federal Reserve really needs to, you know, prioritize employment, you know, keep, you know, the labor force growing so that we can get wage growth going so that employers face pressure to raise wages. They don't
What do you want? They've had 0% interest rates for years and years. How much more can they do?
I mean, you know, as we saw in the last unemployment report, you know, the unemployment rate didn't change, but we saw hundreds of thousands of new jobs. That's because of the people coming in on the sidelines. And, you know, as Alicia was saying, you know, there's still plenty of slack left in the labor market, you know, in my report.
We get that. So but I don't know how much more the Fed can do. Maybe something, but what else?
Well, do no harm. Do no harm.
Don't bump it up. Don't crank them up. What else?
Yeah. So then, you know, another part of that is, you know, the share of 30-year-olds who are in unions is about a third of where it was back in 1984. Unions do a great job of,
and you're talking,
you
something
know,
like 5 or 6% who are in unions.
Yeah.
So that doesn't
yes.
sound like that's going to come in and sweep things to glory anytime soon. What else have you got?
Well, you know, there's also, you know, one thing that young adults are definitely going to face as they get older is they start raising families. And one thing especially women face is this thing called the motherhood penalty, which is that women's earnings go down when they have children. And a lot of that is explained by, you know, having to take part-time work, having to take time out of the labor force to raise children. Policies such as paid leave and subsidized childcare would make it a lot easier for workers, especially female workers, to balance work and family and, you know, keep their earnings up and possibly even enjoy what men enjoy, which is a fatherhood bonus for when they have children.
Paid leave and daycare. Logan in St. Joseph, Missouri. Thank you very much for calling, Logan. You're on Our Time is Short, Logan.
Yes, hello. I'm actually driving. I just came out of Vermont today. I'm an over-the-road truck driver.
Great.
I'm 27. I wanted to pass along this message. I'm 27. I graduated high school in 2007,
yep.
which I felt was relevant. A lot of people my age are NEETs, you know, not in education, employment, technology, so forth. Just kind of feel like we're forgotten. My personal story.
You feel you're forgotten. And forgotten by whom? What's going on?
Well, the message is like Bernie Sanders or Trump, you know, the revolution. A lot of people feel passed up by elites and government. Just don't understand the story of young people right now. Feel like a forgotten generation, really.
Logan, we're not forgetting you here today. We hear your voice. Over-the-road truck driver doing what it takes and feeling forgotten at the same time. We're going to come back to this and do even more with it because this matters. This is the future. Brendan Duke, I want to thank you for the report you've done. When I Was Your Age, Millennials and the Generational Wage Gap for the Center for American Progress. Brendan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Alicia, what's your word to Logan and others? Hang in there? Gets better?
No, I think there are some real reforms we need to consider around the way we finance higher education and the way we help people complete higher education. We shouldn't be forgetting those people who graduated from high school and who want greater education.
Alicia Sastre-Modestino from Northeastern University, our great thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.